Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Coming up on this week's show, a classic lands on the Amiga after 29 years.
Parenting like it's 1999.
And we chat with game audio legend Richard Jakes.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our sponsor, our friends at Bitmap Books. Now, coming soon from them, actually landing this week, 50 indie games that changed the world. Now, this book is a real celebration of some of the most important titles from outside of the typical AAA studio system, including some retro-style games like Shovel Knight, Dead Cells, early indie masterpieces like Super Meat Boy and Limbo. If you love the indie game scene, this is a must-read. Weighing in at more than 450 pages. You can check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at Replay Events. Now, very soon, they're going to be heading over to Liverpool for the very first time, holding the Liverpool Gaming Market. Now, the date for your diary is Sunday, the 14th of September. If you haven't been to one of these events before, you can expect just obviously loads of like-minded people, loads of traders there as well, and pick up some amazing bargains. You'd have to pay for a postage of costs and all that kind of thing as well, obviously. So if you want to check that out, the first ever Liverpool Gaming Market, link in the show notes or head to liverpoolgamingmarket.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 494, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ashley Kingston.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show. No Ravi this week. That does mean nice to have Ash back on the show, dialing in from his very glamorous hotel tonight.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, I've got a fantastic view over the steelworks across the road from the hotel in lovely Cardiff. So yes, but not the first time I've done these things from hotels or been on the Retro Hour get together in hotels as well. So yeah, all good. Kind of getting used to it.
It's always cool you can dial in from the road. I mean, actually, we're going to be talking about the early days of the internet on one of the stories that's coming up in just a bit, because that's what we do on this show. We let you know what's been happening in retro gaming and technology from over the last week. And that second half of the podcast is when we welcome on industry legends to tell us their story. Now, I've just got back from a weekend in actually very sunny Norway. It was lovely out there. Bit of a heat wave when we're out at Sandefjord for the annual Retro Messa event. Got to say a huge thank you to everyone that came to check out the panels. Loads of listeners came over to shake my hand as well. Quite a few of which were attending the event for the first time. There's one guy actually told us he actually flew over from England because he heard it on the podcast, which I thought was awesome.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is just such a good event every year. I mean, you've been out there before, Joe, you know, just how cool that place is. And the bit that I love as well is we get access to people that otherwise we probably couldn't get on the podcast, including a lot of guests from Japan, which we'll be talking more about over the next few weeks. And obviously we'll chat more about Retro Messa when Ravi's back, because obviously we're over that side of the world. He thought he'd take a bit of a trip for a week. So he's exploring kind of Eastern Europe and everything over the next week. So we'll chat a bit more about the event when Ravi returns next week. But actually on the podcast today, we're going to bring you the first of the panels that we did at Retro Messa over the weekend. Now, this was with a lovely guy called Richard Jakes. Now, he's got an incredible history in the industry. He's a composer. You probably know some of his huge video game soundtracks. One that you might remember, Joe, Sonic R on the Saturn.
Yeah, yeah. Remember that one? It's got like a very dance 90s kind of pop soundtrack, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, there's a song on there called Can You Feel the Sunshine?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Which actually is hilarious because there's hundreds, if not thousands, of people that have covered that on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's kind of gone viral. In the interview, he played this little montage of like all the different cover versions and anything from, you know, like teenage girls singing it in the bedroom to like metal bands covering it.
Absolutely.
It's like really took on a life of its own. So, and particularly with that, it's interesting that we talk about this in the interview, that it's one of those kind of rare examples where a song from a game actually took on a whole life of its own. So, I mean, you know, the Saturn wasn't a hugely successful system. Sonic are not all that well, not that fondly remembered, I'd say, by most Sonic fans. Would that be fair, do you think?
Yeah.
It's not one I've ever played.
Yeah.
It's a racing game, yeah.
Not everybody's favourite, but it's definitely not just the soundtrack, but the game, I feel like, has had like a bit of a resurgence. I mean, I mentioned this last week, probably through meme culture a little bit, but it's mostly remembered for its soundtrack. There's definitely a community out there of just, you know, gamers who are massive into, you know, that kind of era, late 90s and the early to mid 2000s, like soundtracks of Sonic, you know, like Sonic Riders and Sonic Adventure and Sonic R, you know, and I think that a lot, it probably started with Sonic CD, you know, the Western version, you know, Sonic Boom, Sonic Boom. But Sonic R, I feel like, was the next one to have one of those kind of like dance pop soundtracks. And it came, definitely became a thing for a good decade with Sonic. And there's definitely a big following for that.
I didn't know he did Jet Set Radio as well. That was, I didn't realize that was him in terms of helping with the sound on that as well.
Yeah. I mean, if you think of that game, I mean, how funky was the soundtrack on Jet Set Radio? It's like hip-hop styles in there as well, your breakbeat funk, loads of electronic styles. He worked on, yeah, the original one, he did a track or two on there, then he worked on Jet Set Radio Future. He did a few more on the Saturn as well, including some of the racing games like Daytona USA, Champion Circuit Edition, Sega Touring Car as well. And then he was at Sega at an interesting time in the 90s because he started working on Mega Drive stuff through the Saturn, and then he was there for the launch of the Dreamcast as well. I mean, he kind of saw all that, and we talk about that in the interview, and then went on to do some other massive games, including Headhunter, which was a huge point in his career, a full orchestral score that he actually recorded at the legendary Abbey Road Studios.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so for a musician, doesn't come much bigger than that.
Excellent.
He's well-known for that as well. He did like Mass Effect after that too, so really known for blending orchestral scoring with electronic music as well. Definitely one of the most respected names in music, and some great stories from his time at Sega. He's going to be our guest. Richard Jakes, recorded live at Retro Mesa in Norway, on the show in around half an hour from now. First bit of the podcast, so let's have a little chat about what's been happening this week. Bit of a geek out. Where are we starting this week then, Joe?
Where are we starting this week? We're starting with, I didn't know this existed. And the article says, like, only hardcore Sega fans know about this. And I was like, I thought I was hardcore, but clearly I'm not.
Joe is officially softcore.
I've never heard of it either.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, but you don't say you're like a massive Sega fan, do you, Ash? So
No. To be fair, I had a Super Nintendo, so.
Yeah, fair enough then. But the headline is Sega Laserdisc emulation has just taken a major leap forward. So the actual thing that's happened this week is somebody has emulated the Sega Laserdisc player, which was a Laserdisc player for the Sega Mega Drive and the Sega CD in Japan in 1993. And I didn't think I'd ever heard of this. I watched a little bit of the video about it and looked up some pictures of it, and I recognize it. So it's definitely kind of like, you know, in the depths of my brain, seen this before on the internet. But do you know anything about it, Dan? Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah, well, I've watched videos about this before. And again, like you, it was something that was kind of stuck in the recesses of my mind. I was like, yeah, I remember watching.
Yeah.
I can't remember who did it. It was something probably like a decade ago. But it was a collaboration back in 1993. So it was Sega and Pioneer.
Yeah.
And it was a module called the Mega LD that actually was for their Laser Active system.
Right.
So that let you play Mega Drive / Genesis cartridges, Mega CD discs as well, but also there was special Mega Laserdisc games as well.
Yeah.
That actually used some of their, obviously, the Laserdisc technology. Basically, looking at it, the visuals of it are what really stand out, you know, way beyond what a normal Mega Drive can do. But yeah, again, it's something that was only really
a thing for hardcore collectors. Mm-hmm. And it cost $970 for the base laser active unit.
Was it like a standalone unit or?
No, it was basically an add-on, wasn't it, for the laser active, which was a Laserdisc console.
So it was a laser active, which was $970. And then you could buy this add-on unit, which was essentially a Sega Mega Drive / Sega CD that clipped to the bottom of it. So it'd be, what, pretty much $1,500. And yeah. then they had a handful exclusive laser active Sega Mega Drive games on there, which previously have never been able to be emulated because of the technology is so obscure. But somebody has now actually emulated it. But how he's emulated it is he's actually used a physical hardware tool to rip the game and then turn it into a ROM, essentially. And it's a little bit buggy. So he's currently, the plan moving forward is he's going to decompile it and then kind of like remove the bugs and rebuild it. But it's the first time we've been able to emulate these games, is my understanding of it.
I think what's interesting is what they were saying about the actual video footage and the laser disc. So the ROM element of it's straightforward because it is just a Sega Mega Drive
game,
you know, ROM file.
Right.
But what they've had to do is, from what I understand on it, is they've had to get the laser disc image and sort of rip it almost like a traditional file.
Yeah.
But then they've had to try and get loads of versions of it and as much footage as they can because each one's got problems on them. They've all got corruption. And so what they're trying to do is sort of splice together almost to get like an unfiltered version that's got all the bugs taken out.
Right.
So okay. I don't know quite how they're doing that, but I thought that sounds quite interesting. Yeah, I don't know why they don't just upscale it or something. Yeah. No, but
yeah, I guess that'd be cheating, wouldn't it? It'd be frowned upon. But I that makes sense because, like, obviously we're a audio podcast, but from a visual point of view, it's, you know, I assume the Laserdisc part of it is the background, which is from looking at the games, they're mostly like rail shooters, and the background is a 3D, you know, kind of like track, like in the vein of like Wipeout or something, you know, futuristic track.
A bit like Tron.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, like Tron or something that you're flying down and then there's a 2D pixel spaceship at the bottom, which is shooting enemies and shooting bullets and stuff. So I imagine the pixelated, you know, the pixel art is the Sega, that's the Mega Drive part of it running. That's the Mega Drive ROM. Yeah. And then that's interlaced running over the top of the Laserdisc footage.
Yeah. If you've ever played like a Microcosm before, that kind of works in a similar way. So it's kind of the streaming full motion video off the Laserdisc and then, the Mega Drive visuals laid over the top. Turns out there were nine games released for it back in the day. So it's, you know, some interesting ones. I've never heard of any of these and they're all Japan only releases. Yeah. So
when you look at the 3D rendering on them, on the video, which I presume will be the link, but it's definitely got that 90s pre-rendered vibe to it. It is full on 90s pre-rendered vibe. It's brilliant.
Yeah, 100%. It reminds me of like a cheap 90s movie, you know, like where the CGI is not very good.
Or corporate video.
Yeah.
And you say that, I bet it cost hundreds of thousands of pounds to render these back in the day.
Absolutely. No doubt about it.
Yeah,
I do love the way it looks. Very nostalgic. So that's going to be running on the regular version of the Ares emulator when it's all tidied up and running. If you want to get a little look at that, I'll link that story in this week's show notes. Now, something big is landing on the Amiga, something that many people say should have happened 29 years ago. But this is something that I don't think the Amigas of the day that we all had in our bedroom could have really handled back then, because they're looking at the requirements for this new version of The Settlers 2, which is coming to the Amiga after 29 years. Going to be a beautiful, physical, big box game, officially licensed by Ubisoft. We'll talk more about the requirements in just a minute, but that is a big story. This is going to be launched at the Amiga 40 event that's going to be happening in Germany in October, getting its official launch there. And this is The Settlers 2 Gold Edition, especially the 1997 version of the game, that is landing officially on the Commodore Amiga. You guys fans of Settlers? You play it back in the day, Ash?
Oh, the first Settlers I absolutely loved. It's such a good game, but I used to spend absolutely hours playing it. But I was one of those naughty boys who had a backup copy of it. And so basically I didn't have any instructions.
Right.
And so I think it took me about a month to learn actually how to even play the game. And there were still elements years later that I still didn't fully understand how it worked. But I did love it. It was such a good game. And that music, that's got to be like the world's longest Amiga mod track. It's 14 minutes long.
Oh, God.
Is the mod file that plays in the background. And it's such a good sort of rendition of medieval music. It's absolutely brilliant. I still play that on YouTube now and stuff. So, but no, absolutely brilliant game. You know, graphics.
Do you remember how many discs it came on for that massive mod?
It was actually only three discs.
Right.
Because the first two discs were the intro. And the intro animation, which nobody ever really watched, and after the first time anyway. And then the final disc was the actual game file.
Mm.
So actually, really, the game only was one disc. The mod file, I do have a copy of the mod file on its own, and it's 248 kilobytes.
Right. Just like, yeah, so a quarter of a disc.
Yeah. You got it. Yeah. I don't know how they got a 14-minute track into 248 kilobytes, but there you go.
Yeah, they could do some impressive stuff back in the day. But obviously, by the time the second game came out, 1996, MS-DOS, Mac OS got it as well. And then there was a release for the Nintendo Wii, randomly, in 2007.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently so. But then the second one didn't land on the Amiga, because I mean, you think by 1996, kind of the commercial life of the Amiga was kind of, you know, definitely on the wane by then. And also, as I kind of touched upon on the start of this story, it does require a exceptionally beefy Amiga to run this game. So this is actually a fully optimized version. Interestingly, it's from a good mate of ours, Nico, and the team at Look Behind You. We know them. So they distributed all our books, didn't they, Joe?
They did.
Made them in Germany for us. Great bunch of guys. And, you know, anyone that's read our book will know that, you know, that their quality is second to none. We're really impressed at the job they did there. But also they're huge Amiga nuts as well. So they've actually managed to get this version of Settlers 2 Gold Edition licensed by Ubisoft. Now, the thing is, they do say that it's intended for AGA Amigas, and they also say, or Power PC as well. Because there is a lot in here. You've got thousands of animated objects in here, more than 30 different professional groups, six soldier types as well. There's some of the add-on packs and stuff are in here too. So they're saying the minimum spec is an Amiga with the AGA chipset, which was the more advanced graphic architecture that's found in the Amiga 1200 and the 4000 and the CD32. It requires a 040 processor running at 40 megahertz, which I know you're an Amiga lad back in the day, Ash. I don't know about you. I didn't know anyone that had anything like that in their Amiga back then.
No, I mean, I had a 68030 in mine, so I wouldn't have been able to run it. But yeah, I was thinking, you know, even on emulation, it's probably going to be a little bit of a stretch for some of the mini Amigas and stuff, and
yeah,
lower powered Raspberry Pi type ones. So yeah, be interesting to see.
Well, we were looking, weren't we, before we started recording. So we wondered whether the A500 Mini could run it.
Yeah.
And it can do AGA and it can emulate, they say, about up to an 030, maybe an 040 at a stretch. So it might run, but probably wouldn't run all that great on there. You need 30 megabytes of RAM, 600 megabytes of hard disk space as well, which is huge for an Amiga game. So really, I think they're aiming this at like either people that are running it via high-end emulators, like, you know, WinUAE on a top-spec PC, or the Pi Storm, which is obviously a way to harness the power of a Raspberry Pi to accelerate an old Amiga. Very common way of doing it and very affordable way of doing it. So if you've got one of those in your machine, should be able to run it. The PowerPC version as well is quite interesting. So basically, back in the 90s, after Motorola stopped making the 68K processors, you know, like Apple moved on to PowerPC. It was kind of the logical step that a lot of companies took. There were like some third-party Amiga PowerPC accelerators. So there was like it was almost like a patch that you'd run on the Amiga operating system, called Warp OS or Warp Up. So basically, if you've got that installed and you've got one of the old PowerPC accelerators, you can run it on there. But also it'll work on like Morph OS via that route as well, if you've got that on like a Mac. So really it's, you need a real high-end Amiga to run this. But I don't know about you, I just think like they're launching this in Germany, looking at the box of it as well, seeing the Ubisoft logo and Amiga together on a box in 2025, I think is just awesome.
Yeah, I definitely think it's, and timing as well with the 40th birthday.
Yeah.
I think, and you know, being released in Germany as well with the celebrations going on this year in Germany, I think, you know, it's brilliant timing. So I think there'll be a lot of people who really are after this. So be interested to see how well it does.
One thing I did spot is Gamescom is obviously on this week. So I'm recording this actually on Tuesday evening. I see the launch parties are streaming right now. First day's tomorrow, 20th of August. But a couple of people I know are walking around the exhibition at the moment before it opens. And I did spot that Retro Games Limited are there. And looks like they've got a stand where they're going to be, by the looks of it, I'd imagine they're going to be debuting their A1200 Maxi computer there, because there's like a big stand there with a picture of it on there and the logo. And then, interestingly, underneath, they've got the Settlers 2 logo. So I'm wondering if that means it's going to be bundled with Retro Games Limited's the A1200 when that comes out.
I'm hoping it's going to be. That'd be an awesome bundle. Because I've said to you guys for a long time now, as soon as the A1200 Maxi comes out, yeah, that's an impulse purchase for me. So if it came with Settlers 2 as well, I'd just be made up.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's a good time to be a Commodore and Amiga fan, isn't it? You've got plenty of options out there. And the fact we're getting games that I imagine, you know, you're probably the same back then, Ash, if you had an Amiga, looking at thinking, oh, I wish number 2 came out. You know, you need to wait 3 decades when it finally is going to arrive in a few weeks' time.
But I mean, I think all those sort of ones that came out around about that time, though, were struggled on the, you know, the later games struggled on basic Amigas. I remember having Theme Park on the A1200, and I don't think I could really play it properly until I got the 68030.
Yeah.
And then it just had enough grunt to sort of just about chug its way through.
So even having an 030 back in the day, I had like a pretty, I think I had an 8 megabyte expansion in my Amiga 1200.
Yeah, I'd say. Yeah.
And then it was like, I could run like games like Gloom in like a postage stamp size window. That was about it. So, but luckily, you know, more powerful Amigas are much more readily available these days. So I think if they had released this 30 years ago, they wouldn't have sold any copies. I imagine, ironically, they'll probably sell more now than they would have if it came out in like 1996, 97. So,
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool to see. So keep an eye out for that. Landing, if you're going out to Amiga Germany, you can come back with your copy in October. Now, I think we'll let Joe do a Resident Evil story here as well, so we don't get too computer nerdy. Because this one is quite exciting. And normally, I mean, obviously you talk about Resident Evil quite a lot on the podcast, Joe, and we often relegate you to the patrons-only area of the show.
And I did put this into Patreon. Dan's moved it up. He's bumped it to the main news for me.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this at work earlier, and I was like, is it just because I sit in the... because there's actually a Castlevania game that's coming out this week in Japan as well. And I was like, is it just because I follow those games, or is it just because they are super popular and, you know, they just see them a lot online and stuff. But anyway, this has actually come out today. So at the point of recording, so August 19th, it was only announced a couple of days ago. But the remasters of, so not the remakes, but the remasters of the original 90s Resident Evil 2 and Resident Evil 3 Nemesis have been released on PS4 and PS5.
Mm.
I've been waiting for this for years. Obviously, we got them on Good Old Games a year or two ago, the remasters, and you know they've done a lot of kind of like, you know, not upgrades. They've improved like the sharpness and some of the textures, but you know the quality of life things. There is obviously classically you save with an ink ribbon in Resident Evil, but on these versions you can quick save them at any point. That's
cheating.
It is cheating. Well, you think that's cheating? You can rewind time in this as well. Yeah,
I do like that though.
Yeah, I'm obviously going to get these and play them because I'm not a PC gamer. I could have become a PC gamer and played these a year ago, but I've been waiting for them to come out. Only on PlayStation, they're not on Xbox or Switch or anything like that.
Seems weird they wouldn't do a Switch release. I don't understand Xbox because they're not that friendly to kind of ports lately.
Must be some sort of licensing thing because of the original Resident Evil 1, 2, and 3. Originally came out on PS1, and then 2 and 3 did get ported to like Dreamcast and GameCube a few years later, you know, like in the early 2000s, like 2001, 2002. You know, Code Veronica was on PS2, but then was on Dreamcast and then got ported to PS2 and GameCube. So there must be some sort of licensing thing there, because these are based on the original PS1 versions of the game as well. It's not, the Dreamcast versions or anything like that. So they've obviously got the rewind in there, which technically means you could have a perfect play of the game and never get hit and, you know, actually kill Nemesis and get all the secret weapons off him on hard mode and stuff like that, which is what I'm going to be doing. But they have come... I say free, it depends how you look at it. They are on the PlayStation Plus membership, so it's the highest tier. I'm not actually, I don't actually know what it's called, but the highest tier that you can pay for, where you get the retro games on there as well.
Their version of Game Pass with retro stuff, yeah.
Yes, that's the one. But if you do want to buy them separately, they are £8 each. Right. Which, to be fair, you know, usually when you're like, oh, I've bought Golden Axe a million times, I've bought Sonic a million times, in my head I thought they were going to be £15. I kind of just decided they'll be £15. So when I checked it out earlier on, I was like, oh, they're £8 each, like that doesn't offend me in the slightest. Like I'm okay with that, to play, you know, like a kind of slightly upscaled version of these games that I absolutely adore.
I was just going to ask on that, have you done anything to them other than just sort of add the low quality of life stuff? Have they upgraded anything, you know,
all they've done is just polished some textures. That's really all they've done to it. They've kind of kept it, you know, you could say it's, you know, or they've kept it to the authentic, like kind of like original look. Or you could just say they're being lazy, but essentially they've not given it like a complete like overturn or anything like that. They have literally just sharpened up some of the rendering and some of the visuals. So the backgrounds, because obviously they're like pre-rendered backgrounds, apparently they've just made them sharper and clearer. And then they've made the actual, you know, pixel, you know, kind of like polygons. They've just improved the textures on them slightly. They've not done too much with it. So I'd be interesting to see if it looks horrible, you know, on my modern TV, or if it actually looks all right.
You know, I'm wondering as well, it doesn't mention anything about the controls. I mean, they're tank controls, right? Resident Evil 2?
Tank controls, yeah.
They were tank controls. And in modern Resident Evil, kind of like, not the remakes, but like when they remastered Resident Evil 1 remake and Resident Evil 0, which were originally GameCube games, which had tank controls, they implemented that you could literally switch between it in the options menu, like on the fly, do you want to play tank controls or modern controls? I don't actually know if they've done this in this. And then also, I did read in a forum, once again, don't know if it's true, that if you already bought these games when they were on PS3 about 15 years ago, which were just ports of the original, they hadn't done anything with them, they didn't have the rewind or anything like that. Apparently, if you did actually buy them on your PlayStation account back then, these should be free, apparently.
Oh, wow.
But
that's very generous.
Yeah, apparently. I don't know how true that is.
Yeah, not something you expect, you know, to get a free update to a game you bought 15 years ago, if true. Very cool. Am I right in thinking that these games have been remastered, remade, updated, like how many times now?
No, they haven't. So they got remade. So Resident Evil 1 got remade in 2001, and then that got remastered in 2015. Resident Evil 2 and 3 got remade in 2018 and 2019, or was it 2019 and 2020? I think it was. But obviously, they're completely new modern games. They weren't, you know, I've tried to explain this to somebody at work so many times. They didn't have any assets or anything. They're complete remakes. These original games, 1, 2, and 3, 1 got remastered for the PlayStation Network a couple of years ago and was a release game with the retro PS5 games, you know, that came out. But this, I believe, other than ports to Dreamcast and GameCube and, well, N64 as well for Resident Evil 2, they've never been like remastered before, other than the PC releases we got a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so if you haven't got a gaming PC and you want an easy way to play them, and obviously, you know, now that spooky season's coming up, Joe. Till Halloween.
So, I'm playing them next week, brother.
It's always Halloween in Joe's house. So, cool. I mean, you know, I haven't played Resident Evil 2 since, God, back in the 90s. So, I think for that price, like, you know, sake of £8, might give that one a download, I think. Sounds interesting. So, I'll link that story in there. All the rest in the show notes, too. Now, something else that is celebrating an anniversary. There's been a lot of these going on recently. You know, we mentioned the Amiga's 40 this year. It was actually 30 years ago this week that the Plus Pack was released for Windows 95. Don't sound too excited, boys.
I was just going to say, the Plus Pack, there's probably a lot of people going, what?
Including myself.
Well, this was basically, it's a CD that you could get with a load of extras on for Windows 95. The one I remember the most is that you get like a bunch of wallpapers and themes. There's one that I'd always run called, I think it was Inside My Computer it was called, and actually ripped the sound effects off YouTube.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
They would get annoying really quickly. So you'd have them on for like a day, then yeah, silence everything. But one thing that it came with on the Plus Pack, obviously the 3D pinball game, but Internet Explorer was bundled with it as well. But it was actually 30 years ago this week that Microsoft introduced Internet Explorer, first released on August the 16th of 1995. And obviously introduced a whole generation to the wonderful world of the internet. Remember your first web browser, Ash? What was the first one you used?
I didn't get a PC until quite a bit later on. I think my first PC was about 1998.
Yeah.
So I was into Windows sort of 98 territory by then. So Windows 95, I went to friends' houses and played on theirs and stuff. So I did see it, but didn't really use it much. So in terms of browsers, I was originally probably Netscape Navigator that I used in any sort of anger. And it was the one, obviously, we had at university as well, because that was what all universities used. But yeah, I don't think I really started using Internet Explorer until, you know, probably really into early 2000s.
Yeah.
So yeah, I ran on Netscape for quite a while, but it was just because it was what I was familiar with university, which was really the only access I had to a PC at the time. So
I remember first getting online. We had a few PCs at school that appeared with internet access on them. This would have been around this time, 95, 96.
Yeah.
I think I've talked about it in the podcast before. You could basically, it was in the library. Four computers that no one ever used. You could go to the person in the library and basically say, can I book an hour on the internet, please? And they give you a little laminated bit of card with a password on there. You'd sit down at one of the machines. They ran Windows NT, I remember.
Yeah.
And then, you'd load up Netscape and you'd get a little timer to start in the corner, you know, counting down from 60 minutes before you had to, like, stop. And basically it was try and download as much as I can and save them to floppy disks in like an hour. But for me, it was always like Netscape. Yeah, I remember, you know, the N logo with a little comet in the background.
Yeah.
Seeing that.
That was the first web browser that I actually did any web page programming on. I can't remember. What was it called? Architect?
Composer,
Netscape,
didn't
Architect
it?
Something?
Netscape Composer, I think.
Composer, was it?
Yeah.
Because at university, we had to create a web page for one of those projects we were doing. So we had to learn some basic web page authoring back in the day. So, yeah. But, I mean, to be honest, it was a decent piece of kit for the age. You know, you didn't need to know HTML programming language or anything. It was kind of drag and drop to a degree and stuff. So, you know, powerful thing, really. A lot more powerful than what Microsoft was doing at the time, put it that way. But, you know.
Well, that's the thing, because Netscape was, you know, so dominant, wasn't it? And then there was obviously Bill Gates' famous internet tidal wave memorandum that he sent around Microsoft, which was 30 years ago this year as well, when basically he looked and thought, oh, hang on, we need to get into this internet thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the end, he nearly got Microsoft broken up over it, didn't he? You know, with all the controversies and everything. So it was, you know, quite a important and, I suppose, famous and infamous at the same time, really, was Internet Explorer. So, yeah.
Well, I'll link this article up in the show notes. It's on a website called The Silicon Underground. There's a great little article kind of detailing a bit of the history of Internet Explorer, which at its peak in the year 2000 had a 95% market share. So, you know, Internet Explorer, massive back then. And then they kind of go through the story of how really Microsoft kind of got lucky, because Bill Clinton's government ended and then Bush came in, and really that kind of changeover is what stopped Microsoft getting broken up, because the Justice Department changed it over and the suit wasn't resolved by the time George W. Bush assumed office, and they kind of dropped the matter. So, yeah, they mentioned if the outcome of the American election that year had been different, Microsoft might not be, you know, what we know today. So, yeah, I mean, as much as I hated Internet Explorer, really, you know, it's obviously a very important legacy there.
They still haven't really given up, though, have they? You know, brand new PC, first thing it asks you is, use Internet, Microsoft Edge.
Yeah.
And what's the first thing you type in? www.google.com.
Download Chrome, sorted. Yeah, never use it again.
There you go, yeah.
Even though I hear off everyone that apparently Edge is really good these days, but it's just, maybe you're like me, it's that legacy of Microsoft browsers that just makes me not want to use it just because I'm using IE for so many years.
I think it's just familiarity. I've got so used to using Chrome now and knowing what everything is. I don't want to learn another browser when it does the same kind of job. I think probably that was how Microsoft got it with the Internet Explorer. It became ubiquitous and that's it. Everybody just got so used to it.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see how long Google's got the reign for, won't it? Because, you know, history is a habit of repeating itself.
It's weird that, because I was talking to someone in Norway about that over the weekend. They're like, it kind of feels like we've got a lot of standards now that have kind of stuck. Like, you know, the Facebook for social media, I know there is like a move away from young people using Facebook now because it's kind of what their parents use and it's a bit uncool.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's been around for like, you know, 20 years now. Chrome's been the dominant browser for over a decade. It just kind of makes you don't really see anything else on the horizon coming through. Not as quickly as it was back in the 90s where, you know, Netscape came and went in like half a decade, really, didn't it?
Yeah. But I think that's the thing. It's just they've almost got culturally bedded in, haven't they? And yeah. I suppose it'll take the next generation to sort of break that habit. Particularly as, dare I say, we're all getting a bit older and a bit more stuck in his ways, aren't we, these days? So, you know, it's harder for us to adapt.
Well, actually, that leads quite nicely into our next story, which is an article on The Guardian about the movement of 90s parenting, which I thought was quite interesting. I thought it'd be quite cool to chat to you guys about this. Obviously, you're both dads.
Yeah.
So I think, is this something that kind of appeals to you? Now, basically, I'll explain what the trend is. It's an article in the Guardian's lifestyle section titled Why Everyone's Parenting Like It's 1999. And you might have seen this video that's been, I think it's all over socials this week, from a guy called Justin Flom. Now, he's a father of two, content creator based in Las Vegas. He actually built a replica Blockbuster video store for his daughters inside one of the rooms of his house. And he talked about how back in the day, you know, he's got fond memories of piling into the car with his parents, going down to Blockbuster, you know, roaming the aisles and deciding what to watch. And I imagine the smell of the popcorn as well on a Friday night in there and how exciting that feeling is. And he mentions that, you know, scrolling online, like going through Netflix or Amazon Prime, this isn't quite the same feeling. And there's something special about choosing a film together in a physical place and then making it an event. So, I mean, are you guys doing anything kind of, I mean, I know you haven't built a Blockbuster in your basement, Joe, but
is there anything?
I've been quiet this week. I mean, is this anything, something they're talking about how, you know, some parents are using tapes and CDs or letting the kids play on their old consoles? I mean, is there anything kind of you do to, like, you know, make sure that your daughter's not just kind of on screens all the time? I mean, apart from going out to play, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I read this article earlier on, and I got to be careful with what I say here. I don't want to sound like I'm coming across on like a high horse or anything like that. Mm. Like, you know, my daughter never watches TV or anything, like, because that isn't the truth. However, interestingly, this is something that's been on my mind the last couple of weeks, and I'll give a little bit of context to it as well. But interestingly, I obviously haven't made a Blockbuster video in my basement. I have made a Hollywood movie in my attic. But I did actually start on a Friday night. Me and my daughter do a movie night because I pick her up from school on a Friday. We've got into a really lovely habit of we have a movie night. And obviously, like, we have Netflix, we have Disney Plus, we've got Amazon, even BBC Three. You know, she watches stuff on that, not BBC Three, BBC iPlayer. And it's overwhelming, especially for like a 4-year-old, you know, to pick something when there's thousands of things to pick from. So I can't remember where I got the idea from, because I'm not going to say I came up with the idea. I think I just saw it on Instagram. But I literally, on a Friday, got into a habit of going onto Word and I would just pick four random films like that she might enjoy. So like Monster Inc., Pinocchio, Snow White, and Homeward Bound. And I just put the movie posters on the Word document and print it off and take it home as a TV guide for her and say, nice. Which one do you want to watch? You know, and then we don't go on. And I'll always slip something in there that I want to watch as well. Like, you know, I've been putting like Labyrinth and Neverending Story on there.
and the original Mario movie.
Yeah,
as well.
And the original Mario movie and stuff like that. Funny enough, we did watch the new Mario movie on there and she did watch that. I don't print them anymore because we got to a point where we had like loads of them. So now I just pick one out of kind of like, we have like a drawer in the couch. And you're like, you know, I just pick one of them out and she picks what she wants to watch. So I read this article and it made me think of that. And I was like, yeah, because of, it's like, it turns my brain to jelly, scrolling, looking for something, even at night when I'm sat on my own and I want to watch TV. And I'm like, well, what the bloody hell do I watch? There's just too much choice. Like, I do miss the days of like, oh, you got four or five channels and you just watch whatever's on TV. You know, that's something she will never experience. But then interestingly, obviously with it being the 6 weeks summer holiday in the UK at the moment, I've just had the last 2 weeks off work. And, you know, my wife said, she made a point of like, we're not having any TV time. Like, we're just having family time. And I was like, okay. Like, that's like...
going out, getting some fresh air.
Yeah, going out and getting fresh air. And like, we were driving along, like, you know, through the town we live in the other day. And I was like, pointing out where all the friends at school live. And I was like, oh, maybe when you're older in a few years' time, you'll go call on them and stuff like that. And then my wife was like, kids don't do that anymore. And I was like, oh, yeah, they don't, do they? Like, they just,
that's kind of sad, though, isn't it?
They just sit in their rooms, like, on WhatsApp, like, talking to each other. And it was just like, it did really get me thinking. And it's like, bloody hell, like, how am I going to try and, like, what's the word, like, incorporate that into her life? Because obviously... these things are going to happen. Like, she's got to, I've got to move with the world. She's got to move with the world.
Yeah. You can't stop it.
Yeah. But I'm interested to see with you, actually, like how it is with you, because your children are a little bit older than my daughter, aren't they? They're like 10, aren't they?
Yeah. I've got an 8 and a 10-year-old, but
yeah,
I mean, I have, we have a sort of similar thing. I mean, they're getting into the age where they do, if you left them alone, they would just sit there on the tablet all day playing Roblox and stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we let them do that to a degree, because I mean, I have to think back to when I was a kid and I literally spent entire weekends on my spectrum and stuff.
Yeah.
So it'd be very hypocritical if I, you know, didn't let them do it. But we kind of do similar things. You know, I play, I've got a Nvidia Shield TV thing for the cinema room. And I've got Lemulator or whatever it is. I can't remember which one it's called now. But it basically is a like MetroArch. It's a full suite of emulators. But it can stream off the network as well. So all my ROMs on the network, I don't need to clog up the storage locally. And me and my daughter quite often play two-player games on that with the joypads plugged into it. So I get to sort of break her out a little bit on there. And also that obviously helps me because I get to play retro games as well. And she enjoys that aspect of it. But the film thing, I know what you're saying. I mean, I have more of a curated list. I mean, I use Plex and I was sort of thinking to myself, well, all my DVDs and Blu-rays are what's on Plex. So I thought, well, that's a curated list. And then I sort of thought to myself, yeah, but I've got like about 700 Blu-ray discs and DVDs and that.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden it's not as curated as you think, is it? But we sort of did the same thing. I mean, she has her own login to Plex that's filtered, so she can only watch things up to a certain age rating and that. So she'll sort of take herself off to watch some of the films of that. To be honest, she's getting, because said she's 10 now, she's getting a bit older, and she's wanting to watch more teen or adult type programs. And I don't mean adult in the online safety apps kind of way. I mean,
it's your private Plex server. Yeah, you need a password for that.
Yeah, it is. But it was like this weekend, my wife was out on Saturday, and I was with the kids, and my daughter watched Dune with me. the, you know, the more recent version. And I looked at it, I thought, it's a 12A. And I thought it was going to be a 15 or something, but it is actually only 12A. So I thought, well, okay, I'll watch it with her. And I thought, she's never going to sit through this. You know, like, she's not going to understand any of it and all this and the other. And bless her, she watched the entire film and she was asking me questions through the film about why and what and everything else. And I'm not saying she got, like, you know, even probably 50% of it, but she was interested enough and she wants to watch the second part.
Yeah.
So it's funny how as they get older, they do sort of adapt. But I think you can incorporate that, you know, and I think watching films as a family, we do that quite often, even if they are just like Marvel films or whatever, you know. But and that is, to me, kind of like modern family time. And again, it's no different to when we were kids getting a VHS from Blockbuster and watching as a family on a Friday night. The medium's different, but I think the, you know, the sort of feel of it is still the same if you want it to be.
Yeah,
I mean, they refer to it in this as, like, you know, 90s parenting, but I guess it's really just giving them a break from, like you said, Joe, sitting in the room all the time on WhatsApp or whatever, and a bit of a break. Instead of watching a little screen, watch the big screen with the family.
Basically. It's so difficult. It is so difficult because it's like, you don't want to force, like, your childhood on them, but then it's like, but then you're also like, I want you to play out, but then you're also like, oh my God, why did my parents let me disappear for 12 hours on a summer's day when I was 10 years old?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want my kid to do that. So it's very difficult to find that balance, but absolutely what Ash said, like, my daughter, you know, she's 5 now. If I gave her iPad, she would happily sit on that for 8 hours.
Mm.
You know, we give it to her for, like, long car journeys and that's it, really. And then even then, when you get out the car and it's like, oh, it's time to give the iPad back, it's like, no, like, and she runs off with it, like, and it's like, oh God, you know, you've been on it for an hour.
It is tricky though, because I think we kind of made a rub for his own back. Everyone's so scared of letting the kids out to play these days.
Yeah.
That, you know, we've kind of just kept them in, and then they do what they can do, which is playing online games with each other and this and the other. And I, you know, I did the same. I'm thinking at my daughter's age, I was going out and spending entire weekends around, you know, during the daytime at a mate's house and coming back when it got dark.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we did. And you didn't
have a mobile phone either. You could be anywhere. Yeah.
No mobile phone. And, you know, my wife's saying, oh, well, I'd prefer to have mobile before she goes and does that kind of thing. And I said to her the same thing. She says, well, we didn't have mobile phones. You know, your parents called you by shouting to 3 doors up who had a kid. They would then shout up another 3 doors up to another set of parents. And it was almost like carrier pigeon, wasn't it? You know?
Yeah.
It's like, Ash, your mum wants you back. Your mum wants you back, quick.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, it's nice to hear that some of the, you know, the simpler techniques of the past, like, you know, sitting down and watching a family movie together, that is staying alive, I think. Nice to hear that, guys. And first time we've had a parenting corner.
I know.
Our podcast. So, yeah.
Like, we need sounds like a help group, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Spin-off.
Me and Ash are going to go start our own spin-off, The Parent Hour.
So, yeah, if you want to read more about that, the parenting like it's 1999 trend, I'll link that, and of course all the rest of this week's stories in your show notes. You don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week. Check your podcast app, or you can head through to our website at theretrohour.com. All right, this week's special guest on the way in just a moment. I'm going to be talking to Richard Jakes. His time at Sega, lots more as well. Incredible composer, recorded live at Retro Mesa in Norway. Before we do that, let's take a quick second to tell you a bit more about our sponsor this week, our friends at Bitmap Books, the longest running supporter of this podcast. In about 7-8 years now, we've been with Bitmap Books. Been amazing to work with Sam and the team there. And I think the reason that our relationship has lasted so long is that we're big fans of what they do. You know, we couldn't work with the company for that long if we weren't big believers in the quality of their products. And I'm looking behind me right now, entire shelf full of Bitmap Books books. Now, you've got a few as well, Joe. They're just gorgeous, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, really, really, really nice books.
Just the quality of them. I mean, you know, I've got, even when my mum came to stay with me last week, a couple on the shelf there. You take them down to have a look at them, you know, even if you're not a gamer. They're just beautiful art books. Now, this new one that actually just landed this week that you can get right now, bitmapbooks.com, is called 50 Indie Games. that changed the world. Mm. I was looking back on our guest list on this podcast. I mean, we cover indie games a hell of a lot on this show, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talk about them in the news almost every single week. And then obviously, you know, probably every month we'll have one or two on, you know, you know, modern devs or, you know, indie game devs from the past. It's a huge part of video games and obviously a massive, massive part of retro gaming as well and retro-inspired games, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's one thing about this book. Now, it celebrates, it's obviously a subjective list, mm-hmm. as you know, anything like this is, but I think they've got a pretty good range here. This is from a very experienced video games journalist called Aaron Potter. Hopefully we're going to get on the show for a bit of a chat soon as well, because this history sounds interesting. And this is a gorgeous hardback book that takes an analytical deep dive into each of his featured games production as well, talking to the teams and the creators behind them. And it weighs in at 450 pages. So got stuff in here like Shovel Knight.
Mm.
We're talking about that's like NES style.
Yeah.
Indie game.
Fantastic game. Played through.
Yeah, it's really, really fantastic game.
Yeah.
Super Meat Boy's in here as well. You got Dead Cells, Limbo, and each chapter of the book has got you know, behind the scenes concept art. You got beautiful high quality screenshots as well. The stuff that really only Bitmap Books can do, you know, just looks absolutely gorgeous. So if you're a fan of the indie game scene, which is just getting bigger and bigger. I mean, I went to the Indie Game Awards in Nottingham earlier this year. There's, of course, the Debug magazine as well. You know, whenever I was at Retro Messer at the weekend, the amount of indie developers I saw there. Massive crossover with retro as well. So this covers 50 of the best games in that genre and 16 honourable mentions, indie games that changed the world in both big and small ways by believing in their own teams outside of that typical AAA studio system. So if you're a fan of the indie gaming scene, absolutely worth a look right now. You can check it out. Tell them that we sent you as well. Always helps out the podcast. You can check out their full collection at bitmapbooks.com. Well, we're speeding through August. Your patrons hang out again next weekend.
Oh, my goodness.
That's coming quick.
Isn't coming
it?
Up again. There we go. Yeah. That is quick, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you might be well-placed to explain what the hangout is, Ash, for people that haven't joined us before.
I think the hangout, you know, we were talking about help corners earlier.
Yeah.
the hangout is one of those things once a month. We all get together. I think was it Ravi just on his own for the first one ever? I can't remember now, Dan.
But, let's go back a bit.
You started doing them during, I think, just about the start of COVID.
Yeah.
And it, obviously it's just continued on. And I think at first we just thought it was going to be something we did temporarily during COVID. And it's just proved to be just a massive success. I think, you know, everybody on that chat absolutely loves it. We just get together on a Google Meet call and just geek out for a couple of hours. I usually have a beer or two or three.
You're not the only one.
We just relax, chat. We go on to so many different conversations and topics. It's just half the time by the end of it, we can't remember what we've talked about. There's so many different sidelines we've gone on and everything else. We usually end up talking about films as well, classic 90s and 80s films and all sorts of stuff. But, you know, I mean, the thing for me, I've heard you guys say it before every week when you do talk about it. But I've made some actual real friends from that group and talk to them quite often. You know, there's people on there from different countries who I'm friends with. And, you know, I even got to meet some of them, some of the foreign ones in real life when we were at Kickstart last year in Nottingham with you guys. And, yeah, just the experiences I've had and the friends I've made from it, it's just fantastic. I really look forward to it. And I love that you guys still carry on with that as well, because to a lot of us, it's a really important and fun get together. Definitely. If you haven't been on it, guys, and you're a patron, get on it, because it's just a good laugh. It's good fun and you'll feel loads better at the end of it.
Yeah, it is. I think you've really summed it up perfectly there. And the thing is, we're always very welcoming to new people as well. We get new people through all the time. So if you'd like to join us for the next one that's coming up next Sunday, 31st of August from 8 p.m. UK time, all you've got to do is sign up to our Patreon. All the details are at theretrohour.com. We do have a couple of new members to induct into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, and that is the Retro Owl Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame.
We do have a jingle for that one, even though Ravi's not here. Still got to sing Hall of Fame. Let's induct our new members, though, the first one. And Nicholas Yoff, thank you so much for your support.
Massive thank you to Chris Hurst.
And a huge thank you to Nordfelt.
You all joined us on Patreon over the last week or two. Massively appreciate your support. If you'd like to join our wonderful community, all the details are at theretrohour.com. All right, well, Ash, well, thank you so much for joining us this week. Always fun to have you on to geek out about the news.
Yeah, I'll just see if I get spanking now from Group IT. You are. So.
Yeah. Yeah, we won't mention that you're using your work laptop. So thank you so much.
I'll get a phone call tomorrow. What were you trying to gain access to yesterday?
Yeah, we'll be on the Hangout next week. Yeah. You guys got me fired.
No worries. No, thanks for that. I enjoyed it, guys. Yeah, appreciate you joining us
as always. We'll see you on the Hangout next weekend. And next, recorded live from Retro Messa in Norway. Going inside the world of Sega music and lots more as well with this week's special guest, Richard Jakes, is next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. We've had a brilliant day so far here at Retro Messa 2025. My name's Dan Wood. This is Ravi Abbott, and we host a podcast called The Retro Hour. New episodes land every Friday, and we've done it for almost 10 years now. So, yeah, big back catalogue. Yeah, so you can check that out every Friday on all the usual podcast platforms and YouTube as well. And a big part of the show that we do is interviewing veterans of the industry who've worked on some of our favourite games, the games that we grew up playing basically back in the day. So today it is our honor to welcome someone here who's worked on some incredible games, particularly at Sega back in the day as well. We'll get more into that, but please give a warm welcome to Richard Jakes.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
We're going to be getting into your career, obviously, but I'm interested just personally, where did your like journey in video games start then? I mean, were you a gamer growing up? Where did that come from?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a small home computer for my 11th birthday, as ZX Spectrum. Nice. I was one of those guys. And the first thing I did was trying to make music on it. So I had an old Quickshot 2 joystick, and I programmed it to make different tunes on each axis of the joystick. And I would get up at 5 a.m. to play games before going to school. So, yeah, definitely playing games and making music on computers from a very early age. And I was quite big into the arcades as well in those days.
Did you have any games that the soundtrack really stood out to you? And were there any like chiptune musicians that influenced you at all?
Certainly on the Spectrum, I was sort of taking notice of the music, but the really big one for me that sort of changed everything was when I first played Outrun in the arcades. Mm. And I remember I was on holiday down in the southwest of the UK, and I saw this gleaming arcade cabinet. I think it was the first one that was 50 pence. Everything was 20 pence, yeah. But this one was 50 pence. And I saw the stereo speakers, and I heard the music, and I saw that you could select your own music track, and that just completely blew me away. And the music from Outrun is incredible, so that changed everything for me.
Passing Breeze, yeah.
Were there other musical influences as well outside of the video game world?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I was sort of already starting to study classical music, so I'm a trombone player, a pianist, and a percussionist. So sort of during my schooling, I was playing in symphony orchestras, orchestras. So all the classical repertoire, especially, you know, Shostakovich, Mahler, Stravinsky, etc. And then in my spare time, I was listening to sort of early hip hop, you know, Public Enemy, Run DMC, that kind of thing. And I was just getting into electronic music, artists like Prodigy and bands like that. So it was a very, very broad, you know, taste in music, both what I was playing as part of my studies and what I was listening to in my spare time. So, yeah, very broad range.
You mentioned before about making music on the Spectrum. Obviously, that had a very rudimentary sound chip. I mean, before you went to work in the industry, what was kind of your setup at home and how were you teaching yourself how to make electronic music?
Well, once I had my Spectrum, I then sort of upgraded to an Atari ST. Yeah. I had a couple of quite rudimentary synthesizers and some basic MIDI equipment. And I started sort of writing my own stuff when I was about, I don't know, eight or nine, something like that, and then gradually build up my equipment. So in my early teens, I was messing around writing things that I wasn't necessarily thinking about video games, but, you know, looking at artists like Jean-Michel Jarre was really huge around that time, playing concerts in London. So lots of synthesizer based music I was sort of trying to make and learning myself with the process and teaching myself.
What software were you using? Was it C-Lab?
Before that, there was another program I was using called, was it Hybrid Easy Tracks? I think it was called something like that. Yeah. And then, yeah, I went to C-Lab Notator, which then became Logic Pro. Which
and having that MIDI connected up to your computer.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Traditional instruments must have really helped.
Yes, it did. Yeah, yeah. Having my synths hooked up and then having the sort of traditional instrument experience as well.
Well, how did you end up then going to Sega Europe, like, pretty much straight away?
No. Yeah, it was funny because I was doing my music degree and I was in my third year of my music degree and I was working part-time in a video shop. And one of my colleagues saw a job advertised for an in-house composer with Sega Europe. This was in 1994. And I sort of wrongly assumed that a lot of the music then would have been written in Japan because a lot of things were cartridge-based and the big players, you know, Sega, Nintendo, Namco, etc., I thought they would have people in-house there. Anyway, I sent some music, some demo tapes off, and I got called for an interview. Then they asked me to send some more music, which I did, and then I got called for a second interview. And I think on the day of my second interview, I'd just paid about $80 for a copy of Virtua Racing Japanese import on the Sega Mega Drive. So I think that impressed them that I was into my games as well as my music. And yeah, out of roughly 300 applicants, I was given the job. So I finished my music degree on a Friday and moved to London the next day and started Sega on Monday, the 4th of July.
I think. Wow. What was the interview process like?
It was kind of, you know, sort of an hour with two of the development team, one producer, one development director, asking me about my sort of gaming knowledge, asking me about my musical background, any games that stood out to me, any game soundtracks that stood out to me, and, you know, sort of why I wanted the job. And a lot of it was about how I would create different styles and how I would approach different projects, having to create lots of different kinds of music.
What was Sega like in the 90s then? Because it was, you know, at its peak.
Yeah,
it must have been amazing going into there. And what was the atmosphere like?
It was a fantastic place to work. I mean, you know, we're in the heyday of the Sega Mega Drive. We're just coming into Sega Saturn and then into Dreamcast era. So, yeah, the Sega Mega Drive was hugely successful and popular, especially in the UK. So we're kind of riding a crest of a wave, really. So yeah, it was a fantastic time, and I had a lot of creative freedom. I got assigned some amazing projects, some from Europe and a lot from Japan. You know, one minute, oh, can you please write this game? Can you please do a couple of tracks for Daytona? Can you please work on Shinobi and Sonic and all those kind of things? You know, you have to sort of pinch yourself a bit because they're huge IPs.
What setup did you have in your studio as well? Did it increase? And
oh yes, Sega gave me a rather nice budget to build a studio. I had to. That's the first thing I had to do, was build a studio within the office. So I went shopping and bought lots of nice synthesizers and computers and speakers and all the rest of it.
Must have been a fun shopping trip.
That was a fun day.
I mean, that time at Sega as well. I mean, obviously, Mega Drive was still huge. 32X had come along. We had Mega CD. What was kind of the build-up from that era to the launch of the Saturn then? What was that kind of like? What memories have you got of that time?
Well, I knew that I would be working primarily on Saturn titles because that was the kind of lead time in 94 when I joined, and the Saturn was due to launch, I think, 95. So that was really why they were expanding the teams and getting me on board to work on Saturn titles. So I did one 32X game, but then I went straight onto Saturn within 6 months of starting my position there. And it was really interesting seeing all the developers coming on board, and I would have to also speak to other developers about the technical aspects of the console. That was kind of fun. I had to learn about the sound chip in the console and try and get through the badly translated Japanese manuals and things like that. So it was fun and challenging, but great sort of place to be at the time.
So you were kind of doing in-house internal Sega stuff. Were you also dispensing any advice out to the companies of how to use this?
We were working closely with, in those days we had Sega Japan, Sega America, Sega Europe. So those were the big hubs for both publishing and game development. But I would also, go out to visit European developers and put on third-party development conferences, which I would sort of talk about the music and the sound aspects of the console. So, I was quite involved, and I was writing music and doing sound effects during the day. So very busy time.
Was it quite a big team, the in-house?
I think the development was around 100, but then there's all publishing, there was third-party support, there was a big QA department, localization, all the graphic design, marketing. The whole shebang, really.
One of the big titles that you worked on the Saturn was Sonic R, which was a racing game with the Sonic characters. On foot, I remember, as well. Most of them weren't in vehicles. And the music for that, I remember playing that, and it really stood out as kind of really upbeat pop tracks that you made for it, including Can You Feel the Sunshine, which still there's hundreds of cover versions of that on YouTube and everything as well. What memories have you got of working on that game, and why did you pick that kind of direction for the sound of it?
Well, I was actually in Tokyo visiting Sega Japan, and I had a meeting with Sonic Team and with Yuji Naka. And it was his choice to go for that style of music. And originally, there was a J-pop artist called Nami Amuro, who was hugely popular at the time. And they said, can you have a listen to this kind of music? And I got the fact that it was really fast, energetic, upbeat. And I think initially, they were looking at using... they wanted me to write the music and the lyrics, but they were looking at a German artist called Blümchen, in Blossom in English. And she was signed to a record label who wouldn't release her. So they said, okay, still write the music, but find a singer. So I found TJ Davis through a friend of mine. And I spent a few months writing all the music and all the lyrics. And I basically wrote the first song, Supersonic Racing, and then Yuji Naka approved it and then said, yeah, we want it to be all like that. So... yeah, that's how I did it. And as you said, there's been a life outside of the game. I don't know how many people play the game, but the soundtrack's over 50 million streams on Spotify and endless cover versions. And actually, I've got a little video if you'd like to see it. I put this together just to sort of demonstrate how music that, video game composers write can literally take on a life of its own. So this is one of the songs from Can You Feel the Sunshine, made by many, many different people.
Hey, what's going on, everyone? My name is Jesse. This is the Auditorium, where I react to video game music. Today is a debut on the channel, I think. Sonic R. Anyways, let's go. Can You Feel the Sunshine from Sonic R. Oh, that's cool. Oh. Oh, so much is going on already.
This is a Sonic video game. Like, why? This is not necessary. It does not need to be this good.
There's nothing for me to do. Can you feel the sunshine too? It's coming through. It makes me feel brand new. When you're here, I
Amazing. Come on.
That kind of, does that blow your mind a bit, watching that and seeing that reaction to a game that obviously you did 30 years ago and it was on, you know, a platform that wasn't huge, and it's more remembered than the game now?
Yeah, I think the soundtrack, you know, like I said, took a life of its own on, you know, not that long after the game was released. And, you know, some people liked the game, some people weren't too keen on it, but then it was ported to other consoles, it was on PC, I think. Yeah. It was in the Sonic Gems collection. And then just since then, there's a whole new generation of fans that, you know, weren't even born when I wrote those songs, that discovered just the songs through Spotify or YouTube or whatever, and then they just like listening to it, and I feel very humbled at that, and it's great to know.
It must have been interesting with... you know, a new Sega console coming out and the Sonic game, kind of making that fast-paced soundtrack. They must have been really happy with the way that it worked. And did you have much, like, dance music, rave kind of influence and what was going on in the clubs there?
Not too much. Not for that game. There was another one, which I'll come on to in a second. But for that particular soundtrack, it was more about what was happening across Europe with the kind of sort of happy house scene, happy hardcore, that kind of thing, where the tempo of the music was just so much faster than traditional sort of club music. So that was the thing that made it stand out more, and that's what I really sort of took from it and made it kind of happy and hopefully uplifting and upbeat, and that's what they kind of wanted, and that's what I wanted to.
And you've seen that vibe go into further Sonic games in the future as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, so, you know, it was a good, fun title to work on.
Well, tell us about some other Saturn games that you worked on. So you worked on a few of the arcade races on the Saturn as well.
Yeah, Sega were porting a lot of, you know, like you said, from the arcade. So I worked on, off the top of my head, Daytona Championship Edition, Sega Touring Car, probably a few others that I can't remember. But yeah, a lot of those things were getting additional tracks, but, you know, both courses and music tracks added to them. So it was kind of getting extra value for the player on these newer versions. So I was working on quite a lot of those titles as well.
Yeah, and you kept that arcade vibe as well. I mean, it always felt like the Saturn was an arcade machine at home, really.
Yeah, I think that was one of the kind of selling points, where we could get, you know, Daytona, Virtua Fighter, Virtua Cop, whatever, on your home console. And I was playing those games a lot, you know, in the evenings outside of my day job. So yeah, it was porting a lot of arcade consoles and giving the player extra value for money and extra content.
Well, do you remember the first time you saw a Dreamcast or a dev kit?
I remember seeing a Dreamcast dev kit, yeah. So we're going to about 99, I think, now. And all these rumours were sort of flying around in magazines and things about, you know, graphics power and this, we're going to use these chips. And, you know, obviously I couldn't say anything. But I remember seeing a dev kit, and then actually Yuji Naka came to our office with a videotape of Sonic Adventure in development, and we were kind of all blown away. And then we started seeing the titles in development in Japan, and I was already starting working on Metropolis Street Racer, so I was already working on that at that time. So yeah, we were starting to see the hardware and the titles in development around the end of the 90s, getting ready for the Dreamcast launch.
What were the changes audio wise with, of course, you know, the increased capacity of the GD-ROM as well?
I mean, any new console we get, you know, more storage. We weren't limited to chip music now. Like the Saturn games, some were chip and some were CD. I worked on both. Dreamcast now had a much bigger storage medium. We had many more channels to play around with for both sound effects and music. So the limitations were pretty much always already gone then. So, you know, it really opened up the creativity, really. We weren't so limited technically. So it really opened up that creative part of the process.
I'm interested as well, internally at Sega Europe, I mean, what was kind of the feeling of what kind of went wrong with the Saturn? And was it optimism when the Dreamcast was on the way that things were going to be different?
I mean, I'm not a specifically technical in that area, yeah. But I know there was a lot of talk about the dual processing on the Sega Saturn. I think some development studios found it hard. As far as I know, originally the Saturn was going to be more of a 2D based machine, and then they added another processor and sort of focused more on 3D. But again, probably best asking a graphics programmer, but that's what I sort of know about it. And yeah, then 3D graphics were obviously the way forward then for any machine or entertainment in general.
Do you remember the launch and the kind of, like, hoo-ha about the Saturn coming out?
Of the Saturn?
Of the Dreamcast.
Oh, of the Dreamcast. Yeah, I remember, you know, still working at Sega at the time, I was sort of helping out, and there was lots of trade events and parties and things. And I remember some sort of minor celebrities being invited to various parties. And I was showing a lot of press around Sega World, which was a big arcade in London at the time.
And the Trocadero.
That's right. Yeah, Sega World. So I was on staff there, sort of escorting people around in my blue Dreamcast T-shirt and having a lot of fun. Yeah, and I think everyone was just wanting to make it a success, really. It was a very busy time, but I was sort of trying to help the company and all my colleagues in the office sort of do a good launch and make some great games.
Yeah, it was an incredible console. And I mean, you mentioned Metropolis Street Racer there as well. And that game, I remember, it had a soundtrack that were like different radio stations.
Yeah.
So how did you approach making so many different tracks for that and different genres? And tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I was working with Bizarre Creations, who were the developer of that game, and they were developing the game exclusively for Sega. And we wanted, basically, the game was set in three locations. So it was London, San Francisco, and Tokyo, which is coincidentally where the Sega offices were at the time.
Yeah.
And I discussed, you know, the music with the developer, and we agreed that we wanted to kind of give a soundtrack flavor from those cities. So both culturally and kind of the zeitgeist of that late 90s kind of, what was happening in music, but in those three territories. So we figured a radio system would be the best way of doing that. So I ended up writing 27 songs across three radio stations, so 9 songs for each across three radio stations for each city. And then I wrote all of the DJ scripts, and then I recorded all of the DJs. I even wrote fake radio adverts, and we licensed real products, which I think was the first time, maybe the only time it's ever been done. So we actually had real radio ads that you would hear on the radio for your favorite soft drink or whatever actually in the game. And then at the same time, we made a CD system, so kind of an early playlisting system, so that if you didn't want to listen to the radio, you could pick your favorite tracks, save them in a playlist on your own CD, on your little memory card. And then, you know, we gave a lot of choice, and I think that's important because people like different kinds of music, different genres. Some people like to drive to rock music, some to electronic music. So I think that was important to give players that choice. And I had to do all the sound effects for the cars. And so everything you hear in that game, I had to do. So it was, yeah, big project, a lot of work. But really, really happy with the results. It was great, great project to work on.
That's kind of standard in GTA as well now.
Yeah, absolutely.
The radio and also that kind of track selection stuff. One game that really stood out was Jet Set Radio. For me, that totally speaks Dreamcast. When you first saw the design of that, what did you think?
Well, we had an early build of Jet Set Radio sent to the office. So Sega Japan was sharing titles that they were working on. And we had an early demo of it with a few levels and some of Hideki Naganuma's music, his amazing music, by the way. And I saw it and I was just like blown away because, I've never seen the graphic, anything like that. The design, the references to pop culture, to hip hop, to graffiti, street art. I mean, it was just incredible. And then when I was asked to guest on one track for the first Jet Set Radio game, I was just, of course. And because Naganuma-san had kind of created, in a way created the style, I just sort of got it immediately. And because I'd been into hip hop as a kid, it was just it landed on my plate and I just went with it and just did that track in like a day or 2 days or something, and there was no changes and it went straight into the game.
It really had that kind of b-boy culture feel with especially the tagging,
yeah,
and going around. So was it interesting having kind of a Western approach of hip-hop compared to a Japanese approach?
Yeah, probably, because I didn't know a lot about how hip-hop kind of came into Japan. But, you know, I remember as an 11, 12-year-old kid going to see the rapper Ice-T at my local sports centre with, like, 300 people.
Wow.
Who, of course, went on to be, hugely famous. And I was, like I said, I was listening to Public Enemy and Run DMC and LL Cool J and all the Def Jam artists. So I was really into the culture as an individual, as a kid growing up. So it was perfect for me to reference those artists and the music that I'd grown up with and put them into the track that I wrote for Jet Set Radio.
And it really helped with the playful style of the game as well, and those kind of cartoony graphics and futuristic world as well.
Yeah, playful is the word, I think. Even though it's a sort of party hip-hop track, it's a bit funky as well, and it's still got that classic sort of Sega vibe. And like you said about the a classic Dreamcast game, it just kind of encompasses all the Dreamcast worlds.
Well, one title I imagine was quite a big turning point in your career was Headhunter, which, that was recorded at the world-famous Abbey Road Studios. So what's the story there then? How did that happen?
Well, Headhunter is a third person action adventure game. Mm-hmm. Developed by a company in Stockholm, Amuse, as they were. And the director wanted a sort of really cinematic Hollywood-style soundtrack because it's a very narrative-driven game, action-adventure game, like I said. And I thought, well, yes, we need to do this with a live orchestra. If that's for the sound you're looking for, I knew how to do it. I knew who to hire. So, yeah, I put a budget together and got my boss to sign off on it. And that, I didn't realise at the time, that was the very first video game ever to be recorded at Abbey Road with the live orchestra. And that was in January 2001. So we went there for 3 days and recorded the Headhunter score. And a lot of the press came down and sort of were really interested in what we were doing. And a lot of the music press at the time, who sort of looked down on video game music, they really took note and thought, oh, yeah, this is actually serious. This is, you know, high-quality music. And, of course, we've known that for years, but we were... You know, we don't like being talked down upon, and I think it really showed what we were doing in games at that time.
What did it feel like being there, though, at Abbey Road Studios?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, it was the first time I'd worked there. I'd been there for some meetings, and they used to have, it's now the shop, so they have an Abbey Road shop where you can buy all your Beatles merchandise, etc. But it used to be a two-bedroom apartment, and I actually stayed there while recording Headhunter. So I used to walk across the garden into the canteen for breakfast, and then three steps into Studio One with an 80-piece orchestra. Yeah, it was an amazing experience, and I've have an amazing relationship with the studio and maintained right to this day, and I have one of my posters up outside Studio One for a game we'll talk about in a bit.
Cool. Jet Set Radio was hugely successful, and then Jet Set Radio Future came about. So what were the changes that happened, and the kind of brief that you got for that title?
So Jet Set Radio Future, I actually did as I was finishing Headhunter. So I was finishing Headhunter around the summer of 2001, I believe, and they were already making a sequel for Jet Set Radio, Jet Set Radio Future. But Sega had already decided this time to focus more on software, so they'd already announced that they were stopping developing hardware, and they already told me that Jet Set Radio Future was going to be on the Xbox console, the original Xbox. And the general sense that it was more futuristic. It was a little bit darker in tone. By that, I mean a bit grittier. And they'd taken the characters further and the environments further. So I deliberately wanted to take my tracks a little bit in the darker side. So I wrote two original tracks, and I remixed one of Naganuma-san's tracks for that game. One of the tracks I wrote, which is called What About the Future, is quite a sort of dark, techie, breakbeat kind of track, which I, when I look at the visuals, that's exactly what I heard in my head, and that's what I wrote. And there was a really funny Reddit post ages ago about that was the first ever, like, how I invented dubstep, which I didn't, by the way. I'm certainly not claiming to, but they were sort of looking at the timelines and making up some story, but it's not true, but it was just very amusing.
Have you done anything for the anniversary of Jet Set Radio?
Not really. I saw some things online. There was an event happening in the US, I think in LA, a couple of months back. I put a few things online, some sort of memorabilia, some stuff that I had, some pictures of some things I had lying around, and sort of posted those. But then here at Retro Mesa, I was able to perform two of my songs in the concert on Friday night, which was the first time they've ever been performed live. So I performed Everybody Jump Around from Jet Set Radio and What About the Future from Jet Set Radio Future, and I was doing some live DJing and synthesizer playing, and it was, yeah, fantastic fun to play those tracks live.
Are you going to get some of the Jet Set Radio inline blades?
Maybe I will.
Well, after Jet Set Radio Future, you left Sega and you went freelance, and then you worked on the original Mass Effect as well. So what are your memories of working on that, and how did you approach the music on that game?
Well, on Mass Effect, there was actually four composers. So there was myself, Jack Wall, Sam Hulick, and David Cates. And the reason for that is there was so much music involved in that game. There's something like, I think in the first game, nearly 6 hours. And it grew in scope, and it was much bigger than sort of we all expected. So we needed, you know, all hands on deck, so to speak. And I was allocated various parts of the game to work on. Quite a lot of the cinematics. So you saw just then when the player first approaches the Citadel, that was one of the cinematics that I scored. And what's the other one? When you become a Spectre, when Shepard becomes a Spectre, that's one of the ones I scored. So I was doing various different parts of the game, and so were the other composers. And we would share themes, and it was a great experience to work on that. And yeah, it came out, 2007, I think, like you said.
Had a mixture, didn't it? Because it was like synth and orchestral music.
It took a lot of influence from sort of 80s synth bands and synthesizer artists, and then mixed with orchestral elements as well. So it had that nice hybrid, you know, mix of elements, in which I think worked really well. And that was at the request of the game director as well, Casey Hudson. He was saying think Vangelis played with a live orchestra in the Albert Hall or something like that. Tangerine Dream, those kind of references.
So you got into the 007 world,
yes,
as well. What was that like, getting into that, and also the change in kind of graphics and technology and design?
Well, that game was a game called James Bond 007 Bloodstone, which was on the, I think, Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 and PC. So we were already seeing a lot more lifelike graphics coming around those days. And I remember there was a lot of composers that were invited to pitch for the game. I think I was one of about 16. But being a trombone player myself and knowing all of the people that play on the movies, I just hired them all to play on my demos, and it sounded amazing, and the team said, yeah, we want you to do it. I wrote about nearly 3 hours of score, recorded Abbey Road again with all the musicians from the movies, and it's an amazing experience to score a Bond project and keep it British and Abbey Road with those amazing musicians once again, and it came out really well.
It must have been interesting still kind of using instruments like from back when you were using them with MIDI kind of getting back to that and doing it with an orchestra as well in games.
Absolutely, because even though in my early career at Sega I had to use the kind of limitations of the sound chip, it's real musicians that I played with, that I studied, and I'm sitting playing in trombone in orchestras for 10, 15 years as I was studying. So, yeah, to get back to that was absolutely fantastic. And it was right for the game. You can't do a James Bond soundtrack without all those high screaming trumpets, certainly not in that era.
Respect the legacy, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, a total contrast to Bond, you worked on Little Big Planet 2 as well, which is quite a quirky game. I mean, tell us your memories of working on that then and the direction you took that one in.
Well, once again, there was a number of composers because the audio director wanted different kind of styles. And as you said, it's such a brilliantly quirky game, and the music brief is as well. So I had to write everything from kind of 18th century Vivaldi to brass band to sort of postmodern Russian sci-fi technology, and it was just insane. But that actually really helped me with the sort of crafting of the tracks. I think I did three tracks on Little Big Planet 2, but then you see the levels and it just fits so well because it's sort of I remember the director telling me, you know, imagine you're in a classroom and there's loads of bits of, you know, sort of crafting things lying around, and you just kind of make this gigantic palette with bits of string and, you know, glue and all this stuff. And that's kind of what I thought in my head. And it was actually a really good reference for me to sort of put all that together. And then I was fortunate to work on a lot of the DLCs and some other versions. And yeah, and the Muppets was a great thing to work on as well for Little Big Planet. So yeah, and very quirky, very, you know, like completely, like you said, completely different to Bond or Mass Effect, but I think you can see the trajectory of what I was doing from Sega and then since becoming freelance, and it kind of all worked together in that project.
Have you ever released any of your soundtracks as, you know, separate pieces or vinyl or?
Yeah, there's plenty around. Usually it's sadly not really my decision, but there's plenty around. Jet Set Radio, Sonic R, there's vinyls, there's four disc Mass Effects, there's Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah, there's plenty around. Available at your local retailer or on eBay.
Well, speaking of Guardians of the Galaxy, I mean, that kind of mixed your score with like established 80s hits.
Yeah.
So how did that kind of work then? Did you have to kind of fit around them? What was the process there?
That's a really good question. Yeah. I mean, Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy, our game, our sort of version of the Guardians was set in the 80s. Mm. And so I was speaking to the audio director, and it was mainly his choice. I gave him a few ideas for songs as well, but he chose a lot of the songs. I think there was 32 or 33 licensed tracks, and then I was doing the orchestral score, which ended up being nearly 6 hours of music. But one thing we did pay a lot of attention to was to give that cinematic feel and that experience to the player, that if you're playing Peter Quill, aka Star-Lord, and if you're in your house as a flashback as a teenager and there's something playing on the radio, that it weaves into the orchestral score completely seamlessly. So I spent a lot of extra effort doing that. So, for example, there's one part when you're in Peter's house as a teenager and there's Tears for Fears playing on the radio, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, and it goes into a cinematic cutscene that I did with the score, and then it sort of transitioned, and I actually echo the melody from that song with the French horns and the string chords and things like that, just to give that completely seamless experience.
Would you ever do like one of those video game orchestras where you have a huge performance and
oh, a live concert?
Yeah.
Oh yes. I'm lucky to be involved with many of live concerts, going back to 2005. I think the first one I did with Video Games Live, where we did Headhunter, and I've had everything from Guardians to Headhunter, James Bond, Starship Troopers, probably some other scores, played all over the world, Europe and Asia and Australia and the US and Canada. So it's just great for gamers to see those kind of projects with live, with real orchestra, with amazing musicians, and usually have a great varied program of all these different games, and you know, some old, some new, some of your favorites, some stuff you may not know and that you can discover new. So yeah, I'm a big fan of those, and hope to do more in the future.
You mentioned about like live musicians. What do you think they bring to games that digital samples can't match?
The pure humanity that a classically trained, you know, incredibly talented musician. It's the interpretation of the music. You know, composers put the dots on the page, put the music in front of the musician, but it's that human interpretation of our direction, if you like, that can never be replicated by a computer or a sound chip, and certainly not by AI.
One thing as well with incidental music in games, and you know, often background music as well. I mean, I always wonder, is the techniques that you use, obviously a lot of them loop, to make sure the player doesn't get tired of it? Is there any kind of...
It's a little bit more complex than that now. I mean, yes, we used to use a lot of loops back in the day, but now I'm certainly doing a lot more interactive orchestral music, which uses a variety of techniques, both in terms of interactive scoring in a sort of horizontal way by stacking up tracks and crossfading, or in a linear playlisting way and skipping between tracks and various things in between and various combinations of those. It does depend on the style of the game. Guardians use pretty much every trick in the book for different levels, because I had to use different approaches for different scenes. But yeah, that's something that really, really interests me, and I love having those problems to solve, both technically and creatively, and still make it sound completely seamless and smooth without anyone knowing how much effort went into it, like doing 17 versions of a conversation that you might not even get to with Drax and Gamora in Guardians, something like that. But yeah, it's detail. I'm a details person.
Well, we were wondering if anybody has any questions, and if you want to ask, just go down to the microphone there.
Yeah, while you're doing that, I'll just, you've been updating some classic Sega tracks as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting looking at stuff you've written sort of over the years, and that other artists have written. You know, I haven't particularly remixed much of my own stuff, but you know, other people have. And occasionally I'm brought in to sort of update things and things like that, and do arrangements of for live concerts, like some of the Sonic R stuff I've arranged for live performance and those kind of things. So, it's fun revisiting old stuff.
Yeah, it must be. Yeah, we have a question.
Yeah, hello. Nice seeing you again.
Yeah.
You have done so much for so many series, so many games, and have a vast library of so many sounds. I'm just wondering, by all these series you've done in the past, if you were invited to do one more, come back to one more series, which one would you compose for?
To come back to one I've already composed?
Yes.
That is a good...
A game series.
I don't know if I could pick one, that's anything. Because the musical styles are so different. Yes, I'd love to work on... Apparently they're making a new Jet Set Radio, but I would also love to do another Marvel project, because it was one of the most fun experiences I've had. But I wouldn't say no to James Bond either. So it's impossible. I enjoy all of those franchises. They're great fun to work with. I feel very privileged to have been involved with them. So I just can't pick one. It's impossible.
That's fine.
Sorry.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
We have another one.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question about your work in Overwatch.
Yep.
When you enter a project like that, where there's so much music already composed, are there many restrictions on the creative process in order to make the music feel like a natural part of the Overwatch
universe. Yeah, it's a really nice story, this one, actually, because for all composers, you know, you may think, oh, you know, someone hears your music and they just phone you up and give you a big project. It doesn't really work like that in reality. But this one, it did work like that. And after Guardians was released in 2021, I had an email in January that the following year from Adam Burgess, who's the lead composer on Overwatch 2. A really nice email saying, "Hey, I was playing Guardians with my kids over Christmas. We love the game, love the music. We think you'd be really good to work on Overwatch 2." And I'm like, well, that would be nice. Anyway, I got on super well with the team, and he played me some of the already established themes, which I really, really loved. I think they're amazing themes. And then I did a treatment of my own on some of the themes as kind of an audition process. And then they came back to me to write new themes for new characters. So I've written a couple of themes for some of the new characters I've introduced, and then some of the different game modes I've worked on. So there isn't really any restrictions. It's just sometimes they say, oh, this part will involve such and such a character, so please reference that theme. And I call up Adam or one of the other composers. And it's a really good collaborative process, because there's quite a few composers now that contribute to the series. But the team at Blizzard know what style I compose in. They know which bits I'm right for. And yeah, it's always great when I get invited back. I did another one in May, I think, this year, for the later season. I did about four or five tracks for that. So yeah, it's great, great collaborative effort.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hey, I was wondering, in your collaborations with other composers, has it become easier over the years with the new technology to collaborate?
In terms of working with other composers, we don't really write together. I mean, Mass Effect is the only project that I've been on with other composers contributing to the score. And then other games I've been worked on, it's like some tracks here and there, you know, Dead Set Radio, etc. The one good thing about technology is sort of remote recording and things like that. So when I'm recording some instrumentalist or an orchestra, and it's maybe not in my home city or country, having the ability to do that at high quality is really, really useful. And for example, due to the pandemic, when we were recording Guardians at Abbey Road, we went in lockdown, but there's still some measures in place, and the audio director from Montreal couldn't fly to London, so he was sitting in his basement listening to all this amazing musicians recording. And I remember one night he left the stream going, and we were having 16 streams of all the musicians recording, and he said he woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning with this huge like brass sound coming up through his basement, because of course we were starting 5 hours early and it was the middle of the night for him, and all these amazing brass players were playing. So that kind of thing has really helped the process, definitely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Richard, for joining us here in Norway at the Retro Mercer. It's been great to talk to you. Please
thank
give
you
a big thank
much.
To Richard Jones.
Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.